Keep a thing for 7 years and it will come in useful, my mother used to say. A thing can be anything, of course. An object, an idea, or a way of doing. I have seen decades of demolition during which all the old-fashioned things like kitchen dressers and iron pots and oil lamps were turfed out to make way for the appurtenances of the dream kitchen. I've heard no end of derogatory criticism of the old-fashioned ideas and ways. Read innumerable school essays featuring this day and age, as though there had never been a tolerable way of living till this shining, labour-saving, high-speed time. It is amusing to see the old wheel turn, to read of well-heeled Americans taking to keeping goats as a hedge against milk shortage, to be assured on all sides that the in thing everywhere is to dig and sow and bake and preserve, and generally beat inflation by making use of the things to hand. We have whole programmes on television devoted to showing us how to grow spuds. Glossy magazines carry recipes for box tea and oaten bread. Books are published at regular intervals exhorting us to live off the country on a wholesome diet of nettles and dandelions, beech mast and rose hips. This making do with what comes to hand is made to sound idyllic. Now what did we do with the old quilting frame and the griddle and the three-legged pot? In this day and age they have come back into their own with a cynical vengeance. We lived off the country because there was no other way to live. It was not an idyllic life, but it was a good training for survival in hard times. A few acres of unwilling clay in County Monaghan was not a soft allotment. That was why my father bought it cheap. The previous owner, a disheartened old bachelor, had let it run to a fine crop of rushes. Half the thatched house had fallen down. That was long before my time. When I heard about the fields after my father, the result of years of toil were showing. Working day after day, and often by the light of a hurricane lamp well into the night, he had trenched and drained the land. There were no rushes that he did not want. The drains that had been clemmed with weeds were running clear. The fences that had kept nothing in or out had been replaced or repaired. He had made and hung every stout wooden gate on the farm, and he had built a new range of outbuildings with the stones from the quarry in the far field. He had even added some embellishments, like the line of young beech trees along the lane, the little plantations in marshy corners, the laurel hedge before the door, the honeysuckle trailing through the hedges, the pigeon boxes on the gable of the barn loft. Honeysuckle had no use at all, but they liked the sweet scent. Pigeons stole some grain, but they were lovely to look at, and it was bliss to hear them cooing when you woke in the morning. A few apparently useless and not at all decorative things had been preserved. The small rushy bottom looked like an oversight, as did the clump of sallies and the rocky outcrop in the far field that had to be ploughed round. But they were the things to hand and had their uses. The rushes were harvested for flax bands. The sallies were woven into potato baskets. Every house about the farmyard was built from the stone of the quarry. The stones were blasted out and drawn up on a slipe, a very tedious operation. I used to ride down on the empty slipe. It was a cobblesome vehicle. I liked better to be with my father when he was trimming the stones and building the walls of another new house. The pigsty was mortared with songs and tales and riddles. Without knowing it, he was building two structures at once out of the things that came to hand. The stones from the quarry, the mixum gatherum of an oral literature. There was a use for virtually everything. Rushes became flax bands, willows two-handled creels. Bunches of heather became besoms for sweeping up the hearth. Dried goose wings were feather dusters. Chickens were carefully plucked, the breast down and the feathers kept separate. It was a fine thing and kingly to snuggle into a feather bed on a howling winter's night and your head on a down pillow. I see people bidding like mad for down pillows at auctions nowadays. And of course, nobody or anybody would be without a continental quilt, which is just the old feather bed over instead of under you. We slept on the feathers and had the wool of our own few sheep for blankets. It was exciting when the big brown paper parcels arrived and the soft fleecy blankets were tumbled out on the kitchen table. The warm, some woolly smell of them, and they soft as white clouds. In those days it was possible to send our own fleeces to a woolen mill in County Fermanagh and have them woven into blankets, or a brightly coloured rug for the trap, or a length of stout tweed for the tailor to fashion. The mill closed down in the 60s. For many years before that it had relied for raw material on imported wool. Progress demanded the best of everything, not making the best of what was to hand. The rugs and blankets were mainly for export. The blankets done up in cellophane in the shop windows no longer seemed to have anything to do with sheep any more than milk in bottles has to do with cows. I used to gather with the cats into the byre when the milking was in progress, and like them had a warm, frothy stomach full of milk straight from the cow. We didn't know too much about germs then, and I suppose I was running all sorts of hazards. What I didn't know obviously did me no harm. I knew where the milk came from, and the beastings after the cow calved. Beastlands, we called it. I loved milk, but hated the thick yellow beastings with their odd inner body smell. I was always thankful when they were finished. I was even more thankful when we saw the last of the pigs offal. For days after the killing for market, the kitchen would reek with that sickly smell of blood. Fortunately, the neighbours were only too happy to help us devour these great oozy slobs of liver, and I secretly rejoiced every time a batch was carried off to provide another household with a tasty meal. Soda bread hot from the griddle and dripping with our own home-churned butter was another thing altogether. And whatever tasted like the oaten bread made from our own meal and crisp before the fire on the hearth, or the spotted egg of the guinea hen, or the fresh buttermilk, or the little pats of unsalted butter straight off the churn, or the thin slivers of lean bacon eaten raw. I never got it again, till I arrived in Venice many years later. It is a continental delicacy like the upside-down feather bed. Maybe I was unknowingly making my own sortie into Europe. Years later, a German girl gave me a recipe for a dish which turned out to be boxty. We had a great argument as to whether it was German or Irish. Whichever it was, it's a delicacy now. Of all the gadgets about the kitchen, there was nothing to beat the tongs. I suppose they were made by the local blacksmith, as were the crook and the crane and the various hooks for linking the pots up and down. All grand, sturdy things made to last a lifetime. Except for the tongs, they all had an obvious use. The tongs was an implement for the imagination to play with. There was no end to its uses. Building the fire and raking it at night were the straightforward uses. My mother used it to draw the red heaters from the box iron out of the heart of the fire. On wash days, she lifted the scalding hot sheets from the black pot into the zinc bath with it. The kitchen would fill with clouds of steam, and my nostrils tingled with a hot, sudsy smell. When my father came home from market with the salt herrings, the tongs were cleaned and greased and laid on turves across a bed of hot grease. On this improvised gridiron, a row of herrings would sizzle and sputter, their oily drippings keeping the grease aglow till they were brown and crackly on both sides. They were a rare bite, those salty morsels, even if they did send you running to the buttermilk crock. A rare bite, too, was the chicken liver wrapped and roasted in the coals, or the potatoes buried in hot ashes. The tongs was a handy weapon in an emergency. I never saw it used on anybody. But if a stranger wandered in when the men were away in the far fields and showed himself too ready to make his own of the house, a woman felt better able to hold her ground if she had a good grip on the tongs. The like of that occurred very rarely. Most of our itinerant callers were civil creatures, and very welcome for the novelty they brought into our lives. The tongs was more of a precaution than anything. It was a toy, too. When we had a visitor who did not know the game, we played "The moon has a round face, two eyes, a nose and a mouth. The stranger would study the face drawn in the ashes and try to imitate it exactly." It took some time to discover that the secret was in how you passed on the tongues. When we were by ourselves, we sometimes played noughts and crosses in the ashes. And there was the dialogue with a moral concerning the tongues. "Give me the tongues, tappany titty. I thought you were forbid of that bunch in Billy. As you reared them, you have them. Hear them, scare them." An exchange between two children, which father wound up by putting the blame for their name-calling on poor harum-scarum mother. There was little call for toys in an adventure playground the size of a small farm. There were clay and sand and stones and sticks and feathers and leaves and moss. There were weird fungi growths on rotting stumps and mazy crawling places among old roots and low branches. Houses there were and hiding places. Climbing frames and jumps and plenty of scope for the imagination. The fir plantation was a spooky cathedral. The upper corner of the orchard was a fine house with a winding stair that ran by footholds up a steep dike. It had a gallery with a tree that bent over and could be an organ or a throne, whichever way you wanted it. When the regal mood came on, there was moss galore for ermine and ivy for a crown. There was a stage and a ballroom. Some of my school friends were addicted to wee houses. Every time one of them came to play with me, we made a wee house with bits of delf and old saucepans all neatly arranged in imitation of the houses we knew. We worked hard at keeping house for a long afternoon. The wee house was a novelty for me for a day or two. Then I went back to my more fanciful amusements and the whole thing fell into dilapidation. An old tree stump was more adaptable, or the box bush that I used as my reading chair, or the laurel hedge that was a labyrinth of pungent semi-gloom. The only homemade toys I remember, though I never used them, were a bird tree pop gun and the roaring bull that scared the wits out of me. The toy I really liked wasn't a toy at all. It was the throw hook I used to twist the grass rope. When my father fed in the dry grass, I twisted the fragrance and scratch of a whole summer meadow into one long rope made to hold. Bound up in it were the sun and the rain, the songs and the stories, the relationship between father and child. It would expand and contract, but it would hold for a lifetime. We never ate nettles, though some people chopped them up for the young turkeys. Dandelion wine was dry and golden and warming like the sun. There was hardly a blackberry about the place that did not finish up glowing like a jewel in a pot of jelly. The kitchen would be luxurious with its fragrance. I have lived in places since where the blackberries hung on the hedges till they mouldered away and no child was seen picking them. Some people said it was on account of the maggots, and then they'd lewd their sponge cakes together with raspberry jam. I wondered till I read somewhere that the blackberry was a fairy fruit. Would they be depriving the fairies of their due? The hearth was the centre of life and light. It was as ritually appointed as an altar. There was the crook and the crane, the hooks, the bosom and the tongs. There was a box of spit bog fir for kindling and a much bigger turf box. There was the oil lamp on the wall and a container of paper spills beside it. There were the chairs in their appointed places and the tea caddy to hand. The salt box hung on the wall. On another wall, the horse's collars emitted a faint odour of leather and sweat. I was very familiar with that odour. I never had a playpen. My mother sat me as an infant in a horse's collar, from which I took my first basic view of life. Maybe we did not have the best of everything. It was a matter of making the best of what there was. The fire on the hearth, that was warmth and food and comfort and entertainment, cost little except the labour. It was not the ideal of a proud housewife in her dream kitchen, but it never went out. That was a thing. It was a symbol of survival. In these uncertain times, the simple things we did for survival are being recommended as bright ideas to beat inflation. Behind all the bright chatter, the question of survival itself has begun to loom in a far more frightening way than it did to us. We knew that If we made the effort, we would get what would do us. And we were not constantly exhorted to get rid of, change to, treat yourself to, spoil yourself. Don't be a stick in the mud.